Much later that evening, Garvey sat behind the desk in his townhouse study. He was alone, with no watching eyes, and so he permitted his expression to show the bitter anger and frustration no one else was ever allowed to see. He leaned back in his expensive swivel chair, rubbing his eyes. They felt dry and scratchy, partly from fatigue, but mostly, he suspected, from how much reading he'd been doing lately. The reports were piling up, and he didn't much care for the trends he saw developing. The savagery of Father Timon's murder, and Garvey's healers confirmed that the priest had probably not actually died until very close to the end of the catalogue of atrocities and mutilations which had been visited upon him, dwarfed anything else which had yet happened. Yet attacks on the Church of Caris's clergy and laity were slowly but steadily mounting. The majority were still relatively minor: fistfights, vandalized homes and property, anonymous threats nailed to church doors or wrapped around stones thrown through windows. Most of those incidents, he thought, and Doyle agreed, were genuinely spontaneous, the result of personal anger or frustration, and they'd arrested, jailed, and fined several of the people responsible for them. Personally, Garvey would have preferred a punishment that was rather more severe, but Viceroy General Cherman had strongly supported Archbishop Claremont's view that the authorities' response had to balance severity with restraint. Cherman had made it clear that so long as there were no riots or large-scale violence, he intended to allow Garvey and the Regency Council to set policy in such matters. Yet he'd also emphasized his own instructions from Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian to be no more repressive than he absolutely had to be. Most of the time, Garvey appreciated that restraint on Cherman's part. For that matter, most of the time he agreed with the Viceroy General and the Archbishop. But there'd been a handful, a steadily growing trickle, of uglier, more violent attacks, and he rather doubted those incidents were spontaneous and unplanned. He'd been concerned by the pattern he'd seen emerging over the past several 5 days. And now there was this. There was no way to pretend Father Timon's abduction, torture, and murder had been the impulsive act of some individual hothead. This had been carefully planned and executed, and it had been intended as much as a challenge to the secular and temporal authorities as a warning to other reformist-minded priests. "There's restraint, and then there's weakness," Garvey thought grimly. "When they chose Father Timon, they deliberately chose one of the most beloved men in this entire city. They chose to kill the focus of all that love, all that trust, and they did it, at least in part, to prove they could do it. To enhearten the loyalists, who probably hated him as much as everyone else loved him, and to demonstrate that we can't even find them, much less stop them from doing it again, whenever they choose to. I don't think even the Archbishop is going to be arguing in favor of a great deal of restraint when we find the butchers who did this. But that's the rub, isn't it, Corin? First you've got to find them, and you don't even know where to start looking." He hated admitting that, yet it was pointless to pretend otherwise. Oh, he and Doyle had their own agents, and a surprising number of individuals had been coming forward, generally to speak quietly with their own parish priests about things they'd seen or heard. Aided by those hints, Doyle's agents had penetrated at least a dozen individual groups, cells, as Doyle called them, likening them to the individual cells in a honeycomb. But all of them, so far, had been relatively low-level. In fact, most had been little more than groups of drinking buddies with thuggish mentalities. Yet even some of them had operated with more sophistication than they should have been capable of. It was obvious to Doyle and Garvey that there was a far more tightly organized and centrally directed authority operating behind the scenes, one which was directing and using those low-level groups without ever identifying itself to them, and Doyle had come to the conclusion that it had actually been organized and set up, at least in part, well before the Carisian invasion, which, considering the membership of the previous church hierarchy here in Coruscant, suggested it had probably been the work of Father Adrian Wyman, Bishop Executor Thomas's intendant. Given certain suspicions both Garvey and Doyle had come to nourish about just who had actually been responsible for Prince Hector's murder, the general longed for the opportunity to discuss a few matters face to face with Father Adrian. "But it's not going to happen. He's gone too deeply to ground for that," Garvey thought bitterly. "I know the bastard is somewhere inside the city. I know it. But I don't have a clue where, and without that..." Crash! The sudden sound of shattering glass yanked Garvey up out of his thoughts. He came to his feet, right hand reaching instinctively for the hilt of the dagger he'd taken off when he entered the study. He spun towards the study windows, which looked out over the landscaped garden in the townhouse's square central plaza, half crouched, and his heart raced. He waited, muscles taut, wondering how someone had gotten past his sentries. But nothing else happened. It was so quiet, he could hear the ticking of the clock in one corner. Actually hear the quiet swish-click sound of the pendulum as it swung steadily, monotonously. After a few moments, he felt himself relaxing, a little at least, and straightened from his semi-crouch. There was no light beyond the windows, and he stepped cautiously around the end of the desk, eyes sweeping back and forth, then stopped once more. There was a rock on his carpet, lying in a halo of glass fragments. It wasn't a large rock, but his eyes narrowed as he realized someone had wrapped something around it before launching it through his study window. He walked across to it, hearing broken glass crunch under his boots, and picked it up a bit gingerly. It was wrapped in paper, tied with twine, and he held it in his left hand, using the fingers of his right hand to brush away the slivers of glass which clung to it. His brow furrowed, and he walked the rest of the way to the broken window, looking out through the shattered panes. Moonlight spilled down over the garden. The pools of silver and inky black were enough to confuse the eye, but not so badly that he couldn't tell that the garden was empty. No one larger than a midget could have hidden behind its shrubbery or flower beds. So whoever had thrown this through the window obviously hadn't hung about to see how Garvey was going to react. But how had they gotten into the garden in the first place? And having gotten there, how had they gotten back out unseen? Garvey knew the quality of the troopers assigned to guard his residence. If any of them had seen or heard anything, including the sound of breaking glass, his study would be full of armed, angry, alert men at this very moment. Which, manifestly, it was not. He walked back across the glass-crunching carpet and sat back down behind his desk, laying the paper-wrapped rock on the blotter in front of him. He gazed down at it for several seconds, then used a penknife to cut the twine and unwrapped it. The paper was an envelope, he realized, and his own name was written on the outside. He wasn't particularly surprised by the fact that, to the best of his knowledge, he'd never before seen the handwriting, but he felt a tingle of odd excitement as he weighed the envelope in his fingers and realized it must contain several sheets of paper. He had no idea why his unknown correspondent had chosen to deliver his mail in so unconventional a fashion, but he doubted that it would have taken more than a single sheet to express even the most passionate of death threats, which suggested this must be something quite different from what he'd initially assumed it must be. He used the same penknife to slit the envelope and extracted its contents. There were 8 sheets of paper, thin and expensive, covered with closely spaced lines written in the same neat, precise hand as the address on the outside of the envelope. He laid them on the blotter and adjusted his desk lamp, then bent over the letter curiously.
Open! Open in the name of the Crown and Holy Mother Church!
The stentorian bellow was punctuated by a sudden deafening crash as 16 men, carrying a 10-foot, iron-headed ram, slammed it into the closed gate. Whoever had issued the demand clearly wasn't waiting for a response. What? Another voice cried in obvious confusion. What do you think you're doing? This is a house of God! The monk, assigned as the night gatekeeper, dashed out of his little gateside cubicle, wringing his hands, running for the priory's gate even as the ram crashed into it a second time. He'd almost reached the closed portal when both halves of the gate flew abruptly open. A piece of shattered gate bar hit him in the shoulder, knocking him off his feet, and then he grunted in anguish as a large heavy boot slammed down on his chest. He started to shout some protest, then froze abruptly, mouth half open, as he found himself looking up at the point of a very sharp, very steady bayonet, perhaps 18 inches from his nose. It wasn't alone, that boot on his chest. In fact, it was only one of scores of boots, as an entire company of grim-faced infantrymen stormed through the gate. More bayonets glittered, voices shouted harsh commands, and more doorways slammed open, as musket butts and shoulders crashed into them. More of the priory's brethren came tumbling out of their cells, blinking in confusion, shouting questions. They got precious few answers. Instead, their eyes went wide in disbelief as impious hands seized them, spun them around, slammed them face first into stone walls and columns. None of them had ever imagined such a brutal direct assault upon monks of Mother Church, and especially not upon brothers of the Order of Schuler. Sheer stupefied shock at such incredible impiety possessed them. They were the inquisitors of Mother Church, the guardians and keepers of her law. How dared someone violate the sanctity of one of their priories? Here and there, one or two started to struggle, to resist, only to cry out as waiting musket butts hammered them to their knees. How dare you! One of them shouted, starting back to his feet, only to break off with a choked scream as a musket's brass butt plate crashed into his mouth this time, not his shoulder. He went down, spitting teeth and blood, and only the quick shout of a sergeant kept that musket from hammering down on the back of his skull with lethal force. More hands yanked the disbelieving Schulerite's arms behind them. Rough-toothed rope bound wrists tightly, and then they were dragged, none too gently, back into the priory's courtyard. Hard-eyed soldiers slammed them down on their knees, and they found themselves kneeling on the cobblestones, surrounded by bayonets that gleamed faintly but murderously in the moonlight, while they stared up fearfully, numbed brains fighting to comprehend what was happening. Sir Corin Garvey left that to the infantry company's experienced non-coms. His own headquarters lay just outside St. Catherine's Parish, and Father Timon had been just as popular with many of his troops as with the majority of people who'd ever heard him preach. Even the ones who hadn't fully agreed with him had respected him, and his sermons had been energetically discussed by Garvey's headquarters company. After what had happened to him, the general rather suspected those non-coms were going to find it more difficult to restrain their men than to motivate them, and he had other matters to attend to. His boot heels rang on the stone floor as he marched purposefully down the corridor with Yeoman Alston and Captain Franklin Niklos, the company's commander, at his heels. They were accompanied by one of Niklos's squads, and Alston and two of the squad's troopers carried sledgehammers, not muskets. Garvey turned a corner, then looked down, consulting a handwritten sheet of paper. There, he said flatly, pointing at a wall mosaic.
"Stand back, sir," Alston replied grimly, then nodded to one of the sledgehammer-equipped soldiers. "Over there, Jacques," he said, twitching his head, and the soldier nodded back.
He and Alston stood side by side, facing the mosaic's peaceful, pastoral scene, and then the hammers swung in almost perfect unison. The iron heads crunched into the mosaic, shattering tiles. The sound of breaking stone filled the corridor, and through it, Garvai could dimly hear voices from the streets beyond the priory's walls. St. Justin's was one of the oldest, largest priories inside the city of Manchir proper, located in a well-to-do neighborhood, less than 10 blocks from Manchir Cathedral, and the Brethren's neighbors were clearly stunned and not a little frightened by the sudden eruption of midnight violence.
"Well, they'll just have to deal with it," he thought harshly, watching the hammers rise once more. "And it looks like we really did surprise the bastards, too. So maybe the rats I'm looking for are still in their holes. Or," his teeth flashed in a fierce predatory grin, "maybe they're busy dashing down their escape tunnel. I'd almost prefer that, even if I'm not there to see their expressions when they run right into Charles's arms."
The sledgehammers thudded into the wall again. More bits and pieces of mosaic flew. But there was another sound as well, a hollow sound which didn't sound quite right, coming from one of the priory's ancient solid stone walls. The hammer swung a third time, and Sir Corin Garvai's grin grew broader and more cruel as holes suddenly appeared in what had been supposed to be a solid wall. Not dark holes battered into the masonry either. No, these were illuminated from the other side, and he heard a voice saying something frantic as the hammers pounded into the wall again and again and again. The holes in the wall grew bigger, spreading, merging into one, and then an entire section of thin stone blocks tumbled away. Something exploded thunderously. A muzzle flash belched a choking cloud of powder smoke, and one of Niklos's infantrymen cried out as a musket ball slammed into his left leg. Before Garvai could say a thing, one of the wounded man's squad mates had his own musket at his shoulder, and a second shot hammered ears already cringing from the first one. Fresh smoke billowed, thick and vile-smelling, and someone shrieked from the other side of it.
"In!" Captain Niklos barked. "And remember, we want the bastards alive!"
"Aye, sir,"
the squad sergeant acknowledged grimly. Then,
"You heard the cap'n, up it!"
The squad's unwounded members shouldered their way through the hole, the passage of their bodies widening it as they went. The room on the other side was as large as the precise directions from Garvai's mysterious correspondent had indicated. And according to those same directions, it was also only the first of a half dozen rooms which had been hidden by the priory's original architect better than 5 centuries ago. Unlike some priories and monasteries or convents which had changed hands and religious affiliations more than once over the years, St. Justin's had always been a Schulerite house, and Garvai found himself wondering how many other concealed rooms might have been tucked away in the order's other religious houses and manors. No telling, he thought as he ducked his head to follow Alston and Niklos through the hole in the wall. This is the first I've ever heard of any of them. For that matter, neither Archbishop Claremont nor Bishop Kaisi had ever heard about anything like this. Or I don't think they had, at any rate. He grimaced mentally. Damn. Now I'm starting to wonder if even the bishops I trust are holding back information I need. He heard raised voices, angry, threatening voices. They were coming from the next room, and he coughed on a fresh cloud of smoke as he stepped through the door into it. Not powder smoke this time, he observed. Instead, it was the smoke of burning paper, and his eyes smarted as he saw the overturned brazier. Obviously, someone had been burning documents when his men arrived, and even as he watched, Alston was stamping out the last flickers of flame from the pile of paper he'd dumped on the floor. Two men, both in night clothes, stood with their backs against a wall, pale faces strained as they faced the points of his soldiers' bayonets. He recognized one of them without difficulty.
"Father Adrian Wyman," he said in a voice of stone, "I arrest you in the name of the Crown and of Mother Church, on the authority of Prince Divan's Regency Council and Archbishop Claremont, on charges of sedition, treason, and murder."
"You have no authority to arrest me," Wyman spat back.
He was obviously shaken, and there seemed to be as much disbelief as anger in his expression.
"You and your apostate masters have no authority over God's true church."
"Perhaps not," Garvey replied in that same stony voice. "But they have enough authority for me, priest, and I advise you to recall what happened to the Inquisitors of Ferrade."
Fear flickered behind the outrage and fury in Wyman's eyes, and Garvey smiled thinly.
"More of my troops are calling on Master Amael even as we speak," he told the ex-intendant. "And Master Hainry is being visited about now as well."
Wyman twitched visibly when he heard those names, and Garvey's smile broadened without becoming a single degree warmer.
"Somehow I suspect one of those fine gentlemen is going to confirm what we already know," he said. "It won't even take the sort of torture you're so fond of, which, in my personal opinion, is a great pity."
He looked deep into Wyman's eyes and saw the fear flicker dancing higher.
"There's a part of me that regrets the fact that the Emperor and Empress and Archbishop Michael have specifically renounced your own book's penalties for the murder of priests. On the other hand, it's probably as well for the state of my own soul. I'd hate to find myself damned to the same coals as you, so I suppose I'll just have to settle for a rope."
"You wouldn't dare," Wyman got out.
"I'm sure that's what the Inquisitors at Ferrade thought too," Garvey observed.
He examined the ex-intendant coldly for another moment, then turned to Niklos.
"Your men have done well here tonight, Captain, and so have you," he said. "Now I want all of these prisoners transported to Kazimar Prison."
He gave Wyman another icy smile.
"I understand they're expected."
12. A private council chamber, Imperial Palace, Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm.
"Your Majesties."
Prince Narmon of Emerald bowed as he stepped past the guardsman outside the door in answer to the pre-breakfast summons. Caleb and Charlian sat at a table beside one of the chamber's windows. It was still dark, and the moonless, starless winter sky was cloudy enough no one should expect to see the sun even when it finally deigned to rise. The hour was a bit early, even for vigorous, youthful monarchs, Narmon reflected. It was somewhat more than a bit early for him, on the other hand, given that he preferred a rather more leisurely schedule, and he hadn't really expected to be summoned to a conference even before breakfast. The chamber had been fitted with one of Hausmann Foundry's new cast-iron stoves, its chimney ducted into the flue of an enormous but old-fashioned and rather less efficient fireplace, and it was actually comfortably warm, even by Narmon's semi-tropical Emeraldian standards. A tall steaming carafe of hot chocolate sat beside an equally steaming pot of tea, and both were accompanied by cups, plates, and a tray well provided with scones and muffins. Before his arrival here in Chiraeth, Narmon had never encountered the scones, laced with nuts and sweetbriar berries, but they were a local specialty, and he approved of them enthusiastically, especially when they were still hot from the oven and there was plenty of fresh butter available. He brightened visibly as he saw them, and not simply because he hadn't eaten yet. That was rather central to his reaction, but there were other factors. Specifically, since he and Olivia had acquired their own comms and access to Al's computer files, his wife had begun to fuss over his eating habits. Narman himself had spent many hours now poring over those same files with delight, yet he'd been interested in significantly different portions of them. He supposed he was glad they had access to information which told them the truth about health issues the Holy Writ had demoted to rote obedience to religious law, but he could have wished that information had not contained words like cholesterol and arteriosclerosis. It had been quite bad enough, in his opinion, when Pasquale-trained healers had fussed at him about what he ate without any knowledge of the actual reasons behind Pasquale's dietary suggestions. He smiled at the thought, but then his smile faded as he saw the Emperor's and Empress's expressions. "Good morning, Narman," Charlian replied to his greeting. Her voice was courteous, but there was something hard, angry, about her tone. Whatever it was, though, at least it didn't appear to be directed at him, for which the prince was grateful. "Please join us."
"Of course, Your Majesty."
Narman crossed to the indicated chair, facing Caleb and Charlian across the table and looking out through the window behind them. He sat, and Charlian poured hot chocolate and handed it to him. He accepted the cup with a murmured thanks, sipped, then set it on the table before him, folding his hands around it, while he considered possible reasons for his unanticipated summons. His first thought had been that it had something to do with Merlin's mission to Michaelburg, but he'd watched the imagery of Merlin's conversation with Duke Eastshire himself. It didn't seem likely anything had gone wrong there, yet if not that, then...
"Forgive me, Your Majesty," he said, looking at Charlian, "but from your tone, something's happened of which I'm not aware."
His own tone and raised eyebrows made the statement a question, and Caleb gave a harsh, ugly little bark of a laugh. Narman transferred his attention to the Emperor and cocked his head.
"You might say that," Caleb said. "When I woke up this morning, I touched base with Owl. I usually do, and I usually have a couple of things I've got him keeping track of, specific things I'm particularly interested in."
He shrugged.
"Most of them, frankly, aren't particularly earth-shaking. You might call them purely selfish. Things like the baseball scores and standings back in Old Caris, for example. Or keeping track of Hector and Destiny. That sort of thing."
He paused, and Narman nodded in understanding.
"Well, one of the things I've had him keeping track of was Father Timon's sermons down in Manchia. Not so much because of their political implications, but because I've enjoyed them so much on a personal level. So this morning I asked him how Father Timon was coming on this Wednesday's sermon."
The Emperor's face tightened, and his voice went harsh and flat.
"Unfortunately, he won't be preaching this 5 day after all. Those bastards of Wyman's murdered him night before last. As a matter of fact, they tortured him to death, and then dumped his naked body in Grey Lizard Square yesterday morning."
Narman stiffened, and his eyes darted to Charlian. He understood the rage glittering in her eyes now. The Empress had been looking forward to the day she would finally get to meet the priest who had emerged as the spiritual leader of the Coruscantian reformists. He knew how much she'd come to respect Hoskins, and he suspected that the priest's murder, especially at Wyman's direct orders, must resonate with the memory of how so many of her own guardsmen had been killed as the result of another High Churchman's plans to murder her.
"Owl is positive Wyman personally ordered it, Your Grace?"
he asked in as neutral a tone as he could manage, choosing to direct the question to Caleb, and the Emperor made a sound midway between a growl and a snarl.
"Oh, he's positive, all right. The bastard passed the order through Hainry to Amael."
"I see,"
Narman's expression was simply thoughtful, but something harder and colder glittered at the backs of his habitually mild brown eyes.
I must admit I'm a bit surprised by his decision to escalate matters this way, the rotund prince continued after a moment. I realize his communications with Bishop Executor Thomas and the Northern Conspiracy are roundabout and limited, but surely he must be aware their plans are far too incomplete for any sort of direct confrontation with the Regency Council and General Chairman.
Obviously we've all believed that, Charlian said. Now that Narman knew what had happened, he recognized that cold, hard tone as an echo of the hard-won self-discipline a child queen had learned so long ago. It was painfully evident that it required quite a lot of that self-discipline to control the rage deep inside her. Whatever we believed, though, she continued, we were wrong.
I don't think that's exactly what happened, Caleb said.
She looked at him, her eyes considerably colder and flatter than usual, and he shook his head.
What I mean is that I think he's perfectly well aware the Bishop Executor and his secular cronies aren't ready to move yet, and we know he's been trying to coordinate things in Manchia to bring the city to a boil gradually, to touch off the fuse at the moment the Northern Conspiracy is ready. That suggests to me that something must have happened to change his plans.
I believe I agree with His Grace, Your Majesty, Narman told Charlian after a moment.
He reached out and began absently buttering a still warm scone.
Of course, Wyman's always had the problem of those poor communications. Any sort of fine coordination with Shalaya, Stormkeep, and the rest has been out of the question. Still, it's been obvious he recognizes the need to orchestrate his own efforts with theirs insofar as he can. So I'm strongly inclined to believe that some purely local factor, a tactical one might say, and not a fundamental shift in his strategic thinking, produced this decision on his part.
From Charlian's expression, it was obvious Narman's apparent detachment irritated her. The prince wasn't too concerned about that, though. She and Caleb had come to know him well enough by now that she had to recognize the manner in which he normally approached this sort of analysis. It was her own pain and anger which woke her irritation, and Charlian Tate Armagh, for all her youth, was more than wise enough to recognize that as well.
"I've had a little longer to think about it than you have, Narman," Caleb said, reaching for his own chocolate cup. "And I imagine it was actually a combination of things. If I had to guess, I'd say Father Timon was proving more effective in unifying support for the Church of Caris than Wyman had expected. And while I don't think it was what Father Timon truly had in mind, that's been spilling over into an at least grudging acceptance of the Empire of Caris among a significant segment of the capital's population as well. I'm positive Wyman saw that, whether Timon and the rest of the reformists did or not, and I doubt he cared for the impact it was having on his own plans and organization. For that matter, we know he's been concerned about the number of people who have begun quietly passing on bits and pieces of information about his operations to priests like Timon. So my theory is that he reached the point of deciding Timon was proving an unacceptable hindrance and had to go. And the way he had him killed and where he had the body dumped was intended to discourage not only Timon's fellow reformist clergy, but also any members of the laity who might have been inclined to collaborate with them.
All of that makes sense, Your Grace, Narman allowed after a moment.
He took a bite of buttered scone, chewed slowly and thoroughly, his eyes thoughtful, then swallowed.
All of that makes sense, he repeated, and I'm inclined to agree with your analysis. At the same time, however, I believe you've overlooked another factor.
I'm sure I've overlooked dozens of other factors, Caleb snorted. Which one in particular were you thinking about?
Wyman's temper, Your Grace, Narman said flatly. There's not much question that he deeply and personally hated Father Timon for his treachery and apostasy. And the man's a Shularite. For him, this wouldn't be simply a matter of passing a message, important though that must definitely be. It would also be a matter of appropriately punishing a priest for heresy, and the betrayal of his vows of obedience to the Grand Vicar.
In other words, Charlian's voice was even flatter than Narman's had been. It was personal.
Your Majesty, it's almost always personal, to at least some extent, Narman said a bit sadly. If I had a mark for every prince or vicar who's let personal anger push him into some truly outstandingly, monumentally stupid catastrophe, I could buy the temple from Duquesne, and we could all go home and live happily ever after. When you come down to it, this entire war is the result of Jasper Clinton doing exactly that after all.
That's true enough, she agreed after a moment.
What has Merlin said about it? Narman asked, looking back at Caleb.
We haven't discussed it yet.
Narman's eyebrows rose again, and Caleb shrugged.
It was hard enough for me to get him to take the downtime he needs every night, and events persist in throwing up entirely too many good, legitimate reasons for me to yank him back out of it. I'm not going to get into the habit of doing that, unless it's really an emergency, and Father Timon was already dead.
The Emperor waved one hand in a choppy gesture of dismissal.
Waking Merlin up couldn't have changed anything. And he'll be coming back online in another 15 minutes or so anyway. We can wait that much longer before we calm him.
I see.
Despite his own shock and anger over what had happened to Hoskins, Narman felt his lips trying to twitch into an inappropriate smile. He knew he shouldn't have found it amusing, but Caleb's fierce protectiveness, and Charlian's for that matter, where a millennium-old, immortal, virtually indestructible Pika was concerned, was far more evident than either of them probably suspected. And rather touching, too, for that matter. In the meantime, though, Charlian said, I think we need to reconsider how wise it would be to allow Michael to continue on to Coruscant the way he's planned. If Wyman's come far enough out into the open, or at least been willing to escalate things far enough to kill Father Timon, I think we have to assume he'll be perfectly willing to attempt Michael's assassination as well. I know Garvai's been doing a surprisingly good job of protecting the church in Coruscant so far, but there have still been those acts of vandalism, and now they've gotten to Father Timon too. Unless we're willing to send Merlin along to personally protect Michael, I don't think we can afford to risk the possibility that they might get lucky again. Especially when we don't have anyone in Coruscant with whom we can communicate directly using the Snarks.
Your Majesty, there are some challenges I'm more willing to undertake than others, Narman said dryly. Having sailed all the way from Emerald to Chisholm in company with the Archbishop, it's my opinion you'd have better luck forbidding snow to fall or the tide to rise than telling him he can't go to Coruscant because you're concerned about his physical safety.
Despite the somberness of their collective mood, both Caleb and Charlian smiled unwillingly. Then the Empress reached for one of the muffins, as if yielding to the prince's example. Her pregnancy and her morning sickness were far enough advanced that she was extraordinarily careful about what she ate, however, especially early in the morning. The state of her stomach was also the reason she was drinking tea instead of the rich dark chocolate, and she looked rather wistfully at Narman's scone, with its chopped nuts and mixed berries dripping with melted butter, then bit into the plain, dry, unbuttered corn muffin.
I realize he's likely to be stubborn about it, she began, her voice a bit indistinct as she chewed, but Caleb interrupted her with a rueful laugh.
She looked a question at him, and he shrugged. I was just thinking about an officer's evaluation Brian showed me several years ago. It was about a certain Master Midshipman Armach, otherwise known, at least on social occasions, as Crown Prince Caleb.
It was. Charlian's eyes narrowed, Then their darkness lightened with just a touch of true humor. And may one ask why High Admiral Lock Island shared this no doubt fascinating document with you?
He was making a point, actually.
Excuse me, Your Grace, Narman put in, but this is the first I've heard about officers' evaluations. Is this a standard part of your Navy's procedures? Or was there a particular reason one was written about, the midshipman in question?
Oh, they've been part of our regular practice for 30 or 40 years now, Caleb replied. Grandfather instituted them when he was a serving officer himself. Every commanding officer is responsible for writing an evaluation of each officer under his immediate command every year. They go into the personnel files of the officers in question to be available for future promotion boards. He shrugged again. In my case, obviously, promotion boards weren't going to be a factor, since Father had already decided he needed me understudying him in Telesburg more than he needed me serving in the Navy somewhere. Still, I was a midshipman, and evaluations get written on every midshipman, so one got written on me.
I see. And who was the officer who produced this document, my love? Charlian asked.
A fellow by the name of Duncan Yearley, Caleb replied.
Charlian's eyebrows flew up in genuine surprise, and the Emperor chuckled.
He was only a lieutenant at the time, but yes, that's one reason I had Hector assigned to Destiny. And I specifically told Captain Yearley I didn't want Hector told that I'd been a midshipman under him. I doubt he would have anyway, but I just thought I'd make sure.
Under the circumstances, then, should I assume Lieutenant Yearley produced a glowing testimonial to your own sterling character, Your Grace?
Narman inquired with a slight smile as he raised his chocolate cup once more.
Well, that depends on your definition of glowing testimonials, Caleb smiled back. What he actually said was, His Highness possesses a superabundance of that quality which, in myself, I should characterize as tenacity and maintenance of aim, but which, in His Highness's case, I can describe only as sheer bloody-minded obstinacy.
Narman, who'd been unwise enough to be sipping chocolate at that particular moment, spluttered into his cup. Charlian surprised all of them, and herself most of all, probably, by giving a sudden, delighted giggle, and Caleb shook his head at both of them.
I can see why you wouldn't be overly concerned by his ability to deal with a midshipman of Duke Darko's sudden seniority, Your Grace,
Narman said, blotting his lips with a napkin.
No, I'm not, Caleb agreed. Then his expression sobered slightly. On the other hand, his description of me at 13 is only a pale reflection of Michael Stainer at 72. He can outstubborn a dragon. For that matter, he can probably even outstubborn a cat lizard, much less a mere emperor or empress.
I'm afraid you're right about that, Your Grace.
Narman laid his napkin on the table and pursed his lips for a moment.
And while I understand your concerns, Your Majesty, he continued then, looking at Charlian, I'm afraid that on a purely intellectual basis, I'd have to agree with the Archbishop.
I beg your pardon? Charlian seemed too surprised by his statement to be angry over it. And in light of her general mood, Narman continued just a bit quickly before that could change.
Your Grace, his visit has already been announced in Monchir as well as here. Everyone in Coruscant knows he's coming, and they know he's coming specifically to make a pastoral visit and show his support for the local church. If he suddenly decides to cancel that trip, people are going to wonder why. If he announces its cancellation now, immediately, before news of Father Timon's murder has had time to reach us here by normal means, we could argue his decision had nothing to do with any specific concerns about his safety. The problem is that I doubt very much he'd be willing to prevaricate in that fashion. And even if he were, there would be plenty of people, the majority of them, in fact, who would never believe the actual sequence. Whatever we might say, and whatever proof we might offer, It would be generally believed that he'd made the decision only after he learned about Father Timon's murder.
He's right about that, Charlie, Caleb said with a grimace.
And if they do believe that, it will be child's play for the group of four and the Temple Loyalists to portray his decision as cowardice,
Narman went on with implacable logic.
For that matter, let's be honest, that's what it would be in some ways.
Oh!
He waved his hand gently before Charlian could object.
I agree a better word for it would be prudence, Your Majesty. In fact, I'll go farther and call it simple prudence or even sanity. And all three of us know it would be prudence on our part, not his. That we'd have to have Merlin in here to arm wrestle him into submission before he'd agree. But the impression in Coruscant, and probably even in Chisholm and Emerald, would be that he'd stayed away in order to avoid the threat of assassination. I'm sure a lot of people who already support the Church of Caris would be delighted if he did just that. Unfortunately, even more people who oppose the Church of Caris would be just as delighted by it. They'd hammer away at the point that not even the Church's own Archbishop has enough genuine faith to risk death in support of his beliefs. And if they can do that successfully, Your Majesty... The plump little prince met Charlian's eyes very levelly. Then everything Archbishop Michael has already achieved, and everything Father Timon died trying to achieve in Coruscant, would be for nothing. The quiet in the council chamber was deafening. The quiet crackle of coal in the stove seemed almost deafening by contrast, and outside the windows a few dry flakes of snow began to dust down out of the clouds, brushing against the window panes like silent ghosts. The stillness lasted for several seconds, and then, grudgingly, Charlian nodded.
You're right, she said with manifest unhappiness. That's exactly what Michael would argue. And he'd be right, damn it.
She looked down at the muffin in her right hand and discovered she'd been picking it to pieces with the fingers of her left hand.
Worse, I know it too. And worse yet, all I'd do if I tried to argue him out of it would be to make him even more stubborn.
She continued the muffin's gradual destruction for another minute or so, then looked back up, and her eyes were fierce.
But if that's the case, then we are damned well going to send Merlin along with him. I think we could justify that on the basis of what happened to Father Timon, without anyone deciding Michael lacks the courage of his convictions. And if there's anyone, outside me, Caleb would be willing to send Merlin to look after, it would have to be him. And it's not as if we have to actually have Merlin right here in Chiraeth, so we can confer with him when we need to, either.
No, that's true. Caleb's eyes were thoughtful. It never occurred to me, but you're right. We've already been sending him off on little errands for us here in Chisholm, like his current visit to Eastshire. So, we could...
Someone knocked gently on the council chamber door, and all three of them turned to face it. Then it opened, and their eyes went wide in astonishment when Merlin Athrawis stepped through it, as if the mere mention of his name had magically summoned him back from Michaelburg. His boots were thick with mud. More mud had spattered his breeches and the hooded coat he wore over his breastplate and hauberk, and his shoulders were dusted with melting snow.
Your Majesties,
he bowed to Caleb and Charlian, then to Narman.
Your Highness.
The door closed behind him, and he straightened.
And good morning to you, too, Caleb said, his head cocked quizzically,
as the closing door provided them with privacy once more.
Forgive me for asking this, but aren't you still supposed to be in Eastshire, discussing things with Green Valley and the Duke?
I am, Merlin agreed. Something's come up, though. I thought it would be better to discuss it with you face to face, rather than over the comm, so I headed home yesterday.
He grimaced and looked down at his muddy boots.
I'm afraid I didn't put in my downtime last night.
He raised his head once more.
I changed horses a dozen times or so, and I hoped I was going to make it in time to speak to you and Charlian first thing this morning. He grimaced again, this time with a ghost of humor. I hadn't expected the two of you to be up quite this early.
That was because you failed to consider my regularly scheduled bout of morning sickness, I imagine, Charlian said wryly. Admittedly, it doesn't usually get us out of the bedchamber this early, but I assure you we're usually awake by now.
Narman took another bite of buttered scone as the simplest means of suppressing his smile. You're right, Your Majesty. I did somehow manage to forget about that. I apologize. The Sajan bowed to her again, a bit more deeply than before.
You said you meant to talk to us first thing in the morning, Caleb said, as Merlin straightened once more. The Emperor's eyes were intent. Should I assume you intended to discuss certain events in Coruscant?
I see you already know about that. Merlin's tone was just a bit odd, Narman thought. Almost, not quite, but almost uncomfortable.
You might say that, Caleb replied grimly. I've been asking Al to keep an eye on Father Timon's sermons. When I asked him for an update this morning, he told me.
I see. Merlin's voice still seemed just a little off-normal, Narman thought, and felt his own curiosity perk.
We've just been discussing with Narman whether or not we should allow Michael to continue with his pastoral visit, Charlian said. Obviously, Caleb and I aren't especially overjoyed at the prospect in light of all this. So we've been thinking we should send you along to make sure Wyman and his butchers don't take a shot at him as well.
That why? Merlin began, then stopped.
He looked back and forth between Caleb and Charlian for a moment, his expression most peculiar, then cleared his throat. All three flesh-and-blood members of his audience knew a Pika had absolutely no reason ever to do anything of the sort, just as all three of them had long since realized it served Merlin as a sort of time-buying mannerism. Which explained why all three of them found themselves looking back at him in various degrees of confusion, puzzlement, and speculation.
Merlin? Caleb asked, with the stern, slightly rising inflection of a parent who suspects his offspring has been up to something.
Merlin looked back at him, then did another thing a Pika never really had to do, and sighed.
You said Owl told you Father Timon had been murdered, he said just a bit obliquely. I assumed from that you meant you'd asked him for a complete report on the situation.
What was there to ask about? Caleb retorted. Timon was already dead, and it's not as if anything we decide this morning is going to have any immediate effect in Coruscant. For that matter, it isn't even dawn yet in Manchia.
Actually, Merlin corrected with scrupulous accuracy, it is dawn in Manchir, and they're having lovely, clear weather down there, too, I might add.
And just what else is happening in Manchir, Captain Athrawis? Charlian demanded, regarding him with pronounced suspicion.
Well, as a matter of fact, it happens that at this particular moment, Corin Garvai and his father, Charles Doyle, General Sherman, Bishop Kaisi, and Archbishop Claremont are having their first interview with Adrian Wyman.
Their what?
Caleb actually rose an inch or two out of his chair, and Charlian's eyes widened in astonishment. Narman, on the other hand, simply sat back with his chocolate cup in hand.
I'm sorry, Caleb, Merlin said. When you told me Owl had told you what had happened, I thought you meant he'd told you everything.
Well, Caleb said with commendable restraint as he sat back down again, obviously you were in error.
So I've just realized, Merlin replied a bit dryly.
Then he shook his head. Actually, Owl's finally starting to show signs of real autonomous self-awareness. He became aware of what was happening and realized I'd want to know about it, so he woke me up.
The Sajan's artificial face muscles tightened.
Unfortunately, he'd picked up on it too late. Even if I'd dared to go to Manchir to intervene, I'd never have gotten there in time. So all I could do was sit there and watch him die.
Merlin's face was a grim, harsh mask now. Charlian had never seen it quite that way before, even after the assassination attempt at St. Agatha's. Caleb had, on the quarterdeck of the galley Royal Caris, when Merlin realized he hadn't been in time to save King Harald, after all.
"It was ugly," Merlin said quietly. "Very ugly. And I couldn't do one single damn thing to stop it."
His right fist clenched at his side, and he looked down at it as if it belonged to someone else.
"I didn't see any reason to calm you two and wake you up in the middle of the night to see something like that, when none of us could do anything about it anyway."
He looked back up again.
"So I decided I'd wait until I could get back here in person, then tell you. Preferably not until after you'd had breakfast, since I didn't expect you to have a lot of appetite afterward. But when I reached the palace, Franz Asten told me you were already up and that you'd summoned Narmon. I was afraid I knew why."
"All right," Caleb said slowly. "I understand that much, but what's this business about Wyman?"
"I couldn't keep them from murdering Father Tymon," Merlin replied. "But I decided I could keep them from murdering anyone else, and that I'd damned well better if I didn't want even more of the reformists butchered and dumped on street corners somewhere. So I used one of Al's remotes to write a little note, then toss it through Corin Garvey's window."
He smiled faintly, despite his grim mood.
"I think it got his attention, and when he'd read it..."
"So, that's about the size of it," Merlin finished several minutes later. "Garvey's men got Emael and at least 3/4 of the rest of Wyman's top cell leaders. Henry heard them coming, though, and he managed to evade them. And so did that nasty piece of work coming. But Garvey's confiscated all 4 of their main weapons caches, and he's got more than enough people to interrogate."
Merlin grimaced. "They're not being any too gentle about how they ask questions, either.
They're being scrupulous about staying away from the Book of Schuller, but that's not stopping them from being pretty damned insistent. I imagine he and Doyle will be coming up with all sorts of normal leads to help keep what's left of Wyman's organization in Manchir on the run."
"My God, Merlin!"
Caleb had sat silent during Merlin's recital. Now he shook his head.
"Forgive me for asking, but hadn't we all pretty much decided we needed to leave those people alone? Keep an eye on them and build up that database of yours."
"We had," Merlin agreed, "but when they murdered Father Tymon, they escalated things to an entirely different level."
His sapphire eyes were grim and hard.
"Bad enough if they'd only kidnapped him, held him as a hostage while they made demands or something like that. But they intended to kill him from the outset, and they did it in a way which was a deliberate challenge to Archbishop Claremont, to Garvey's authority, to the Regency Council, and even to Chairman. I couldn't let that stand, not when Tymon and the other reformists have been making so much ground in the capital."
"You couldn't let it stand?" Charlian said in a careful tone, and Merlin nodded.
"I couldn't," he confirmed flatly.
There was silence in the council chamber again. Snow was falling more heavily outside the window, and Narmon rather imagined he could feel the day's chill, even from where he sat. Except that the cold breeze blowing down his spine at the moment had nothing at all to do with the weather.
"We tend to forget that Merlin, Nemu Alban, has his own agenda,"
the Emeraldian prince thought quietly.
"We work together with him so closely, and the success of Caris is so important to his mission, that we forget he isn't really a Carisian himself. Not even a Safeholdian when you come to it. I suspect this is the first time since Caleb learned the truth about him that Merlin hasn't even consulted the Emperor before making a decision of such magnitude. I wonder how Caleb and Charlian, especially Caleb, are going to react to that.
And the reason you didn't tell us all this yesterday? Caleb asked quietly.
Because, as I said, I wanted to tell you in person. I hoped you wouldn't have heard about Father Timon's murder before I got back here, since I'm the one who normally monitors what's going on in Manchir. I wanted to give you that news personally, not over the comm, and I wanted to tell you personally what I'd done about it.
Because you expected us to be angry that you didn't even consult with us before standing our entire strategy for Manchir on its head? Was that it?
It was impossible to read Caleb's tone, but his eyes were very intent.
Not so much because I expected you and Charlian to be angry, no, Merlin replied steadily. I did think, though, that since I'd already gone ahead and acted, since it was what we used to call a fait accompli back on old Earth, I at least owed you the courtesy of a personal explanation of what I'd done and why.
Caleb sat back in his chair on his side of the table, gazing at the tall, blue-eyed man in the blackened armor, badged with the gold, blue, and silver of the Empire of Karras, standing on its other side. Narman wondered which Caleb was seeing in that moment, the Imperial Guardsman or the Pika with the soul of a dead woman. Then the Emperor glanced at Charlian for a moment and shrugged.
First, Merlin, let me say, and I imagine I speak for Charlian this as well, that under the circumstances, I wholeheartedly approve of your decision.
He lifted one eyebrow at his wife, who nodded in firm agreement, then turned his attention back to Merlin.
Second, however, I'd like to remind you of a conversation you had once upon a time with my father. I respect you, and in many ways I admire you, you said to him. But my true loyalty, that belongs not to you or to Caleb, but to the future. I will use you if I can, Your Majesty.
The council chamber was silent once more, and Caleb smiled thinly.
Are you surprised I knew what you said to him? The Emperor asked.
A bit, Merlin admitted after a moment. I didn't realize he'd told you about that.
He didn't. Charles Gardana did. Father hadn't told him not to, and when he saw how close you and I were getting, he thought I should know. It wasn't that he distrusted you, Merlin. It's just that his loyalty was first, last, and always to Karras, to the House of Armagh.
And are you angry that mine isn't? Merlin asked softly.
Merlin. Caleb shook his head with a sudden, unexpected smile. It was a bit crooked, that smile, but it was definitely a smile. Merlin, I've always known that. Even if Charles hadn't told me, you have, often enough and openly. It hasn't kept you from offering Charlie and me your friendship, even your service. For God's sake, you flew halfway around the planet to save a life. Of course I could wish, hope. We'll always find ourselves in general agreement. And I'll admit that I would have preferred to have at least a little input before you sicked Garvai on Wyman. In that regard, please feel as free to wake me up in the middle of the night as I've always felt about waking you up. But don't think I expect you to do one inch less than whatever it is you believe your duty requires of you. I'm not that stupid, and I'm not that selfish either, Merlin.
He shook his head again.
There's a phrase you used to me once about someone else. You said he'd paid cash for the right to make up his own mind about something. Well, so have you.
There was another moment of silence, then Merlin chuckled.
I hoped you'd take it that way, he said. I'd be lying if I said I'd been certain you would, though.
And would it have made one bit of difference to your future actions if I decided to pitch an imperial tantrum about your having had the sheer effrontery to make a decision without consulting me and Charlie?
No, Merlin told him a bit wryly. No, not really.
That's what I thought too, Caleb said.
13. Archbishop Michael Sweet, Archbishop's Palace,
City of Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm. Michael Stainer looked up from the book in his lap as someone rapped lightly on his chamber door. The morning had been as quiet as only a winter morning could be. He'd stationed himself by his chamber's eastern-facing window in order to take advantage of the morning light for his reading, but it had also let him look out across the snowy Chisholmian landscape. He hadn't been in Chiraeth long enough for the novelty of the snow to fade, and he found the graceful, floating descent of the snowflakes endlessly fascinating. Arden, on the other hand, had decided snow was a terrible idea. Fortunately for the cat lizard's peace of mind, his basket was large enough to accommodate a truly luxurious, incredibly soft blanket. A gift from Empress Charlian, in fact. And he was currently burrowed down under it, with only the very tip of his nose exposed. Whoever their visitor was rapped again, a bit more loudly. "Yes?" Stainer called, and the door eased open just far enough to admit a human head. The head in question belonged to Father Brian Usher, his personal secretary and most closely trusted aide. "I'm sorry to disturb you, Your Eminence, but Sajan Merlin wonders if he might have a moment of your time." Stainer's snowy eyebrows rose. He sat there for a moment, then slipped a bookmark into the volume in his lap and closed it.
"Of course, Brian. Ask the Sajan to come in, please."
"Certainly, Your Eminence," Usher murmured, and his head disappeared once more. The door opened again, wider, a few seconds later, and Merlin Athrawis stepped through it. Stainer was surprised to see him for several reasons. For one thing, he'd understood Merlin would be remaining in Michaelburg for at least another day or so. For another, he was a little perplexed as to why Merlin might have come to see him in person rather than simply using their comms, since the Sajan's snarks must have told him Stainer was alone in his chamber, which meant no one would have noticed him talking to himself.
"Thank you for seeing me on such short notice, Your Eminence," Merlin said, as Usher closed the door once more behind him. "You're always welcome," Stainer replied with a smile. "All the same, I must admit I'm a little surprised by your visit."
"I'm sure you are." Merlin smiled back, but then the smile faded. "I've just come from a meeting with Caleb, Charlian, and Narman, though. Well," he corrected himself, "I've just come by way of a bath and a clean uniform."
"What sort of meeting?"
"There have been some unexpected developments in Manchir." Stainer's eyes narrowed as Merlin's voice turned unexpectedly grim. "In fact, one reason I'm here is to ask you to join the three of them to discuss those developments. They wanted to wait until after you'd had breakfast, for several reasons."
"Should I assume the unexpected developments in question are less than happy ones?" Stainer asked quietly.
"I'm afraid so, and frankly, I'm also afraid they're going to have some implications for your own visit."
"I see."
Stainer laid his book aside and started to climb out of his comfortable armchair.
"Just a moment, Your Eminence, please."
The Archbishop's eyebrows rose once more as Merlin gestured for him to remain seated. He settled back, cocking his head to one side.
"Yes?" he invited.
"I said that one reason I'd come was to extend their invitation," Merlin said. "I have another one, though, one I really need to discuss with you before I bring the matter to their attention."
"This has something to do with what's happened in Manchir?"
"No, Your Eminence, or not directly, at any rate. It has to do with the discussion you had with Baron Wave Thunder before you departed for Emerald."
"I beg your pardon?"
Stainer blinked, and Merlin gave him an off-center smile. "Before you left Telesburg, Your Eminence, you arranged for Father Brian to deliver several cases of documents to the Baron, documents which had been sent to you from Zion
by way of Madame Dinis.
Stainer stiffened. For a moment, simple surprise and shock held him motionless in his chair, his eyes widening in astonishment. Then his normally gentle face darkened. The eyes which had gone wide narrowed, and his entire body seemed to quiver as a bolt of outrage went through him.
"Merlin!"
he began in a hard, angry voice.
"Please, Your Eminence," Merlin said quickly, raising one hand in a pacific gesture. "I have no intention of violating your confidence in any way."
"You already have!"
Stainer was as furious as Merlin had ever seen him.
"I realize the entire Church of God awaiting is only a farce, and not a good one," he said sharply. "But you know perfectly well that I still take my priestly responsibility seriously. And you obviously also know Madame Dinis came to me under the seal of the confessional."
"Yes, I do," Merlin agreed, keeping his own voice deliberately calm. "And I became aware of it only because Owl gave me the information in a routine data dump. I'm sorry to say it hadn't occurred to me then to put in place a filter which would respect the privacy and confidentiality of your pastoral discussions with individual members of the church. Since that incident, I have."
Stainer glared at him, and Merlin looked back levelly.
"You're perfectly welcome to check with Owl about that, Your Eminence," he said very quietly.
A tense, brittle silence hovered for a moment. Then Stainer's nostrils flared as he inhaled deeply.
"That won't be necessary."
His voice was as quiet as Merlin's had been.
"Your word is more than good enough for me, Sage and Merlin. It always has been."
"Thank you," Merlin said sincerely.
"I must assume, however,"
Stainer continued, with the air of a man deliberately stepping back from a brink,
"that there's a reason you brought your awareness of this particular situation to my attention?"
"There is."
Merlin crossed to the window and stood gazing out into the snow. He said nothing more for several seconds, then turned his head to look at the Archbishop.
"Your Eminence, I became aware of the existence of Mistress Angelic's files purely by chance, and I understand exactly why Madame Dinis wants to protect her identity and her from accidental betrayal. What I don't know, because of those filters I had Owl put in place since your original conversation with her, is whether or not Madame Dinis ever did tell you the identities of those within the temple who had been working with Angelic."
Stainer considered the question for a moment, then shrugged.
"No, she hasn't."
"I'm not really surprised."
Merlin turned back to the window.
"However, ever since I became aware of your conversation, I've been keeping an eye on Mistress Angelic."
"What?"
Alarm tinged Stainer's tone.
"I thought you said..."
"What I've said,"
Merlin interrupted, never looking away from the window,
"is that I don't dare operate the Snarks or their remotes inside the temple proper."
He shrugged.
"I still don't have any idea what all those power sources under the temple are. Obviously, quite a lot of them have to be associated with the temple's environmental services and the automated remotes that keep all its mystic features up and running. I think there's more than would be needed just for that, though, and I'm not going to risk tripping any close-in sensors. But Angelic's townhouse is far enough from the temple that I can keep an eye on it. Cautiously, of course. In fact..."
He looked back at the Archbishop with a strange, flickering little smile.
"I've actually been to Zion, you know."
"You've been to Zion?"
Stainer couldn't quite hide his surprise, and Merlin chuckled.
"That was before I'd been able to tell any of you the truth. Tell me,
Didn't you ever wonder exactly how Archbishop Arake came to take that extremely convenient tumble on Angelic's steps?
Stainer's eyes widened once more, and Merlin nodded.
Wasn't that just a bit risky? The Archbishop asked after a moment. From what you've said, I'd have thought it would constitute a considerable risk of detection.
It did, Merlin agreed. Unfortunately, it was the only way I could think of to head off his pastoral visit, and we needed the time.
That's true enough,
Stainer acknowledged feelingly, and Merlin shrugged.
At any rate, as I say, I've been keeping my eye on her, and to be honest, I'm getting more and more concerned about her safety.
Concerned? Why? What's happening?
Stainer asked quickly.
I'm not entirely certain, Merlin admitted. But she's been making some unusual contacts, and she's been doing some other peculiar things. Among other things, she's got several groups of people hidden away in different places, scattered across Zion.
I haven't been able to identify most of them, but I do know who at least some of them are.
Who?
Stainer asked when he paused.
They're family groups, I'm sure of that much, and unless I'm badly mistaken, they're the families of senior churchmen, vicars, and archbishops.
Brown eyes met eyes of sapphire, and Stainer's chamber was very, very quiet for several breaths.
Those reformers of Adarise,
Stainer said then, very softly.
That's what I think, what I'm afraid of.
Merlin shook his head.
The more I've seen of Angelic, the more I've come to admire her. That's a very capable lady, Your Eminence. And I'm sure she's prepared her own escape route, even though I haven't managed to catch her at it. That's probably a good sign, not a bad one. If Owl and I haven't stumbled across any clues, it seems unlikely the Inquisition would have. On the other hand, there's no way to be sure of that, especially since I don't dare insert remotes directly into the temple. And however good her arrangements may be, the sheer number of people she's trying to get out is going to work against her. I'm sure Clinton and Reyno are already trying to figure out where quite a few of those people have gotten to. And if there's one thing Inquisitors are good at, it's finding people.
I see,